in praise of our elites versus their elites. So how do we react to the emergence of the global superclass? The first step is to understand it. This means understanding what it is and what it is not, what good we derive from it and what problems its existence may create or exacerbate. This means also understanding how it differs from what we have had in the past and how it may change in the future. In the course of this book, I have attempted to address these issues, laying the groundwork for what I hope is a balanced assessment of this group and its implications. In this final section, I would like to recap the core points and to explore where they may lead us. To begin with, we must resist the temptation to reflexively attack elites. As Richard Darman said to me during one of our conversations, elite sounds pejorative. You have to be careful there. He is right. Of course, elite does not sound pejorative if you are attending an elite school or are accepted into an elite company. Elite sounds bad only when it is a code word for referring to the other guy who has what you want and what you may even feel is out of reach. This is, in some ways, the critical issue. Elites are tolerable if we feel that what they have is within everyone's reach. Intolerable and a reminder of systemic failures or injustices otherwise. But elites are much more than tolerable. They are natural, having existed in every society, in every era, and in every area of human pursuit. And they are desirable. They are leaders, innovators, risk-takers. They are the ones among us who excel, possess vital experience, and serve as essential connections among centers of power. Moreover, in the global age, many members of the global elites are pioneers, shedding the blinders and the bonds of national ties, helping to create new markets and new opportunities, stimulating growth, putting in place the infrastructure and initiatives that are linking together previously distant societies. From such initiatives led by the business, financial, and media elites that comprise over two-thirds of the superclass grows tolerance. From such openings also come net benefits even to the poorest in the world. If the rising tide is not lifting all boats equally, if huge imbalances remain and some are growing worse, it is also true that the number of people in the world living in extreme poverty has fallen by nearly 20% over the past 20 years. Improvements are being made, and if we are to criticize this group for what we see as wrong with the system they have played a disproportionate role in shaping, then we must also give them credit where we see progress. Furthermore, the global elites of the early 21st century are different from those that came before. Far fewer have inherited their positions than in centuries past. Many more, consequently, are self-made, living proof that opportunities exist within the system. Further, many more derive their power from the private sector than in the past, many more from entities with global operations, many more from entities that are traded on open markets and subject to the disciplines they impose. These are all positive developments, signs of human progress, and important to note and consider if we are to weigh the influence and role and merits of the superclass fairly. Disproportionate concentration of power. This group mirrors elites of the past in that its members possess a hugely disproportionate share of the power on Earth. Indeed, this is what defines them as members of the superclass. And because they operate globally, with few or no institutional means of counterbalancing their influence, they are dramatically unlike past elites who rose up within nation-states and who, when they overreached, were reined back via traditional mechanisms like the use of force or the leverage of law. Just as elites occur naturally, so too do concentrations of power. In this regard, the ubiquitousness of the Pareto principle is really quite breathtaking. The 80-20 rule, again, for many phenomena, 80% of consequences stem from 20% of the causes, applies across the spectrum. In horse racing, 20% of the jockeys typically win 80% of the races. In the breeding of championship rabbits, 20% of the herd produce 80% of the show rabbits. In a Bose-Einstein condensate, 20% of the atoms produce 80% of the activity. The rule has been cited as pertaining to distribution of words in texts, concentration of oil reserves between large and small fields, and the sizes of things in nature from particles of sand to meteorites. As we have seen, a similar principle also applies to the main drivers of power supporting the superclass, starting with the wealth distribution that caused Pareto to formulate the principle in the first place. Wealth. The richest 10% of the population owns 85% of the world's wealth. What is more, data suggests that there is an 80-20 rule within the 80-20 rule. Among the richest, just a few are the very richest. The richest 2% in the world own half of all global wealth. The world's billionaires, less than 0.00001% of the world's population, own wealth equal to nearly twice that owned by the poorest 50%. Finance. The top 100 financial institutions in the world manage nearly $43 trillion, or about one-third of the world's global financial assets. Of 10,000 hedge funds worldwide, the top 100, just over 1%, control an estimated 60% of the industry's $2 trillion in assets. One investor, Fidelity, with nearly $2 trillion in assets, owns 10% or more of 100 of America's largest companies. Business. The world's 250 biggest companies account for more than $14 trillion in annual sales, equal to about one-third of global GDP. The top 2,000 employ over 70 million people around the world. Religion. Out of roughly 4,000 religions worldwide, only about a dozen have more than 10 million adherents. Only two, Islam and Christianity, claim more than 1 billion followers each, and together they account for one-third of the world's population. Force. The United States and its allies in NATO, comprising roughly 12% of the world's people, account for more than 80% of all military expenditures. The United States and Russia alone, accounting for less than 10% of the world's people, control more than 90% of all operational nuclear weapons. Politics. In a world of almost 200 countries, just a handful dominate multilateral political processes, whether through ownership and voting rights in international financial institutions or veto power in the UN Security Council. Such concentrations, moreover, produce self-reinforcing behaviors, whether it is more money going to the most successful funds or weapons treaties granting certain favors to those who already have the most weapons. Power often leads directly to more power. Another key factor at work is that the most powerful people are closely connected to other powerful people through networks that reinforce power, access, and reach. One metric of such networks is overlapping board and institutional relationships. We have seen how the top board members and managers from the top five companies alone have direct influence over 150 companies and over 20 institutions of higher learning through board, advisory, and executive positions. We have seen how the revolving door cycles between governments and the financial world, the national security community, and defense contractors. We have also seen that these elites are in regular contact with each other. They not only have available to them better means of transportation and communications, but because formal and informal global mechanisms exist to link them, from the G8 to the new non-aligned club of anti-globalists, from Davos to Boao, Bilderberg to Carlos Slim's Fathers and Sons meeting. We have also seen consolidation tying these groups together and making the world's biggest players even bigger, from Mittal Steel's string of acquisitions to News Corporation's domination of the media industry. And with the growth of private equity and the ownership circle of big institutions, we have seen a few mega investors acquire more and more influence over other large influential international entities, as in the case of Fidelity or SAFE, the bank that manages China's unprecedented reserves. So, in our world of highly concentrated power, there is a community of several thousand who, in a sense, hold the keys to the planet. They are the superclass, linked by networks and meetings across clusters and across borders, most speaking a common language, most reading the same newspapers and traveling to the same resorts. You'll find them aboard private jets, in executive suites, and in the seats of political power. And as you observe them, you will see that the group does not look at all like the planet it dominates. Not only is power concentrated within the hands of a few, but the few themselves are concentrated in a few places in the world, predominantly white, overwhelmingly male. A few thousand very similar people whose hands are on the world's most important levers of power and influence, closely connected with one another and sharing interests on issues from market regulation to taxation, from freedom of movement to easy access to workers, from who should possess weapons of mass destruction to who should not. Who needs conspiracies indeed? Agenda setting. Of all the powers the superclass possesses, one of the clearest and most important is the ability to set agendas for the rest of us. These individuals can't necessarily always make final decisions, they can't always project force, they can't always even agree. But in their own organizations as presidents and chairmen, chief investment officers and commanders, they can set priorities, guide critical asset allocation decisions, and determine who among their subordinates will have the most influence. And in the context of meetings like Davos, where specific outcomes, despite Klaus Schwab's protestations to the contrary, are few and far between, what they can do very well is shape a majority view among participating elites, or tap into the zeitgeist of the elite, and thereby set an agenda for the companies and governments they control, and influence the agenda setting of others that follow them, compete with them, or emulate them. Both Schwab and Victor Halberstadt have said to me that the best such organizations can hope for, and something of real significance that they believe is a very worthwhile outcome, is to help leaders shape and set their agendas. Indeed, in the case of meetings like Davos, if you are a big enough sponsor of the event, you really can help create a program agenda that can shape the global agenda. World Economic Forum staff meet throughout the year with these so-called strategic partners to ensure that their biggest concerns are covered in the program. It is one of the benefits of sponsorship. David Sanger, the chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times, has commented to me that he sees agenda setting as the central role that major newspapers and media outlets play. They choose the lead stories, choose where to devote coverage, bring issues into the public eye through reporting and editorials. A clear example is Iraq. For most of the Clinton era, it had faded into the background as an issue. Then, because the major media outlets focus so narrowly on top leaders like those in the White House, when a few in the administration decided to reintroduce Iraq as a threat, the media followed, and Baghdad was back on the front pages. In a similar way, major private equity firms set market prices because there are only a few that can do the big global deals, and they all speak to each other. They can deny it. It doesn't have to be illegal collusion, although it might be. Watch for regulators looking for that in years to come. But it will happen more and more often as those big private equity players increasingly co-invest, collaborate, and share risk. The buzz around big industry events from the Allen & Company retreat to the TED, Technology Entertainment Design Conference, will also shape a view as to what's hot and what's not that has a knock-on effect in terms of investment decisions. Agenda setting can take many forms. It can simply be reflecting the broad impulses of this group to support the market end of the government market continuum. For example, the financial community's agenda for the IMF almost unquestioningly embraces policies of fiscal discipline with inadequate attention to social issues, even those that are directly linked to political sustainability of vital reforms in developing countries. It's not that the core idea was wrong, it is that the balance was off. The same can be said of the Washington Consensus. The Washington Consensus is full of merit, yet its reforms were not sufficiently broad or balanced in scope. It did not focus enough on creating the new stakeholders of globalization by enabling the poor to accumulate and develop assets more rapidly. Nor did it prioritize giving them the training and the access to capital they would need to do so, and thus it sowed the seeds of inequity in places like Chile and Brazil, and the populist revivals that have occurred throughout Latin America and in Russia. When the agendas that are embraced produce results for the powerful much more rapidly, or to a much greater degree than they do for the disenfranchised, it is a warning sign. The superclass does not rule by dictate or direct control, nor does it exercise power through conspiracies or cabals. It has a thumb on the scales and exerts influence not as a unified group, but via its most powerful, activist, or motivated subsets. Has big oil influenced energy policy so that the world has remained dependent on its product for too long? Have the big automakers dragged their feet on major technological breakthroughs that could have produced significant mileage gains? Have major banks promoted policies that enabled debtor countries to pay them back without sufficient regard to the social consequences or the political instability that might be engendered? Have the biggest defense contractors helped foster a mindset of permanent war that has pushed the world's biggest defense consumer, the United States, to outspend its nearest rival 10-1? Do the views of the biggest churches influence national and international politics disproportionately so that it is even possible to conceive of a divide between Christian and Muslim worlds? Have we embraced the market revolution for a quarter century without sufficient concern for its effect on those without the means or access to compete in the marketplace? Clearly, the power curve has been at work in each of these cases, and the connections are there, visible in a not purely circumstantial way. Informal mechanisms of governance. It should be acknowledged, however, that the meeting of the minds of superclass members goes beyond agenda setting to effective decision making. This is particularly true where the gaps left by weak and dysfunctional international institutions, or by the absence of legal jurisdiction or enforcement mechanisms, create a void to be filled. The reaction to America's unilateral decision to invade Iraq in 2003 triggered widespread criticism for understandable reasons. So too did the decisions of the administration to selectively apply international law and principles of justice in its treatment of prisoners. The overwhelmingly negative global reaction was completely reasonable, much as it would be were a bully to impose his will on the weak in any community. The United States argued that given the threat posed, it could not wait for the broken, lethargic United Nations to work. A fair complaint about a lousy system. That said, when the most powerful act without the consent of the community, or possibly against the interest of the community, it is inevitable that discontent and tension result. But when a handful of private equity players price a market, or a handful of financial institutions and the central banks of a few governments determine how a new market is going to be managed by them, or even when public needs are left to be met by a few rich companies and people, there are incomparably fewer complaints, although the phenomenon is much the same, and the consequences of these actions touch arguably more people. There is a notion that many big decisions are made by the market in the global economy, as in the case of gasoline prices mentioned earlier. But we have seen that the market is just one factor among many, some with the control of business and government elites, that influence those prices. It is fair to look further and ask, did the market really decide that it wanted cars that were not fuel efficient, or women's shoes that caused a lifetime of foot pain, or television programming that would addle the brain of a lower primate, or American-style democracy? Or did the people who sell those things, and their close associates who regulate those sales, and those who provide financing, have a hand in it? And if businesses make decisions about where to locate factories based on cost-benefit analysis, because their shareholders measure their success in profits, aren't they sending a message to governments that they want to see lower labor costs, lower taxes, infrastructure that reduces shipping costs, and so on? In global marketplaces, when all things truly are equal, such as the case of unskilled or relatively unskilled labor, the investor clearly has the upper hand. The message is, compete or be passed over. The world may well be flat or flatter, but the playing field is hardly level. It is undoubtedly true that many informal mechanisms of global governance, whether the small committees of the most powerful governments or public-private collaborations between powerful governments and private organizations, fill gaps and make growth and globalization profitable. But when the interests of all are resolved by the actions or inactions of a few, or the system offers the few influence unavailable to others with more constrained resources or access, it is inadequate. It would not have been acceptable if the EU had granted the power to work out all economic and foreign policies to England, Germany, and France because they were the biggest countries. Nor should New York, Massachusetts, and Virginia be constitutionally enabled to impose their will on Rhode Island or South Carolina. It is a positive development that top business and government officials have close ties, and that when seeking to achieve a global goal, they can turn to one another with ease. But if the goals are set in the councils of the few, you end up with distorted results. When the political leader leaves office and goes to work for the big defense contractor, and a friend who has made the trip in the other direction replaces him, whose views are advanced and where is there a space for dissenting voices? When a private conference call among big financial institutions is the way an international financial crisis is managed, that may be the height of efficiency. But the critical question remains: whose views are represented in that negotiation? Who is at the table? Who is not? Elites versus the disenfranchised. For the past 7 years, activists have organized the World Social Forum, a counter-Davos to take place in a developing country at the same time as its Swiss counterpart. It began in Porto Alegre, Brazil, and has since convened in India, Venezuela, Pakistan, and Kenya. Each year, a couple of thousand organizations participate in seminars and workshops that would boggle the mind even of Klaus Schwab. The WSF is often even linked to Davos via satellite for teleconferences that prove rancorous, as one did during the very first such event when Hebe de Bonafini, the spokesperson of the Madres de Plaza de Mayo, called George Soros a hypocrite and a monster. It has been attended by as many as 100,000 participants. The existence of the two events underscores the fact that influence does not come from organizing seminars. It does not even come through numbers. The World Social Forum may have 50 times the registration of Davos. It comes through access to the levers of power. The WSF participants come from unions and left-wing political parties, environmental groups, and indigenous rights activist organizations. They argue that they speak for the masses, but most of the masses have little idea who they are or what they are doing. The billion people who live on a dollar a day may periodically benefit from the efforts of people at Davos or in Porto Alegre, but for the most part, they are as politically impoverished as they are economically impoverished. Even those who can and do vote in local elections often lack the information to make the best use of their vote. However, comparatively well-educated populations have been known to make bad choices with alarming frequency as well. We should be as troubled by their lack of political resources as we are by their lack of other basic needs. How can a global system prioritize asset allocation if those who need the assets the most are unable to be heard unless a movie star adopts one of them or a rock star passes through town? It is great to have Bono or the Gates Foundation or the Clinton Global Initiative speak for them. It would be better to give them the means to speak for themselves. While globalization may lift up the relative position of the poorest somewhat, or reduce the number of them living in absolute poverty, they remain at the bottom of the power food chain, still effectively without a change in their relative status in terms of influence. At the same time, if reforms and changes that have led to faster development have also led, as they have, to the shrinking of middle classes in almost every emerging country except India and China, then the distribution of power in the world is adversely affected. The disenfranchised remain disconnected, and the middle classes, the basis for stability and traditional political power, shrink, while the richest get a much bigger piece of the pie, and with it, more influence. So progress by some income distribution metrics does not automatically translate into progress in terms of power distribution. Elites versus women. I will admit that among the biggest surprises to me as I did the research for this book was people's reaction to the fact that women are so egregiously underrepresented among the global power elite. In an era in which women are increasingly successful playing leadership roles in companies and countries, the facts are still remarkable. As of 2007, there were only 13 women chief executives among Fortune's top 500, 26 among the top 1,000. Michelle Bachelet of Chile, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf of Liberia, Micheline Kalmi-Ray of Switzerland, Tarja Halonen of Finland, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner of Argentina, Borjana Cristo of Bosnia and Herzegovina, Mary McAleese of Ireland, Gloria Macapagal Arroyo of the Philippines, and Pratibha Patil of India are the only women currently serving as heads of state worldwide. A handful of others, led by Angela Merkel in Germany, Helen Clark in New Zealand, Portia Simpson Miller in Jamaica, and Luisa Diogo in Mozambique, serve as heads of government. In congressional bodies, the story is much the same. Around the world, women held, on average, only 17% of parliamentary positions in 2007. The U.S. Congress fell below the global average, with 16% female members in the House and Senate. Yet wherever I went, whether I spoke to men or women, there was hardly a stirring of outrage at this obvious failure of the notion of representative government. Geeta Rao Gupta, the president of the International Center for Research on Women, spoke to me about the phenomenon. "I have seen it too," she said, "and I am surprised it persists to this day. Or perhaps I am not. We still live in a world in which many countries' girls are devalued, uneducated, not even given access to medical treatment that is available to boys. There are many organizations like the one I lead, the ICRW, which are working to address this, and good progress has been made in some areas. But it is still an uphill struggle in no small part because of the imbalances in the global power structure that you have spoken about." As for the absence of outrage, she mused, "while I find it perplexing myself, we are up against a lot of history, a lot of socialization of the idea of gender roles. That doesn't make it any less unfair, though. It doesn't excuse it." Elites and mobility. Today's global elites are certainly more mobile and open to new membership than the elites of the past. There are proven paths to the top that non-elites can aspire to. Indeed, as I have noted, there is much more fluidity among the ranks of elites than there has ever been. That said, these paths are only comparatively more open than in the past. If 90% of the members of the superclass have university degrees, and only 0.06% of Ethiopians, or only 0.1% of Guineans go to college, the open door effectively slams shut. But even in relatively better-off countries, education is the big impediment to upward mobility, whether to the superclass or simply to a better life. Only 6% of South Koreans attend university, and only 3% of Chileans do. In fact, in the world's least developed countries, only 67% of boys and only 61% of girls are even enrolled in primary school. Naturally, for those who do make it to university, the ones who can actually attend the elite schools that make up such a substantial portion of the feeder system to the superclass are few and far between, and typically from wealthy families. And from those schools, how many make it to elite employers that are the fast track to the superclass? Ibrahim Dabdoub of the National Bank of Kuwait observed, "The biggest issue in the Middle East and the rest of the developing world is education, the quality of education. This is, in my opinion, the major factor that keeps the Arab world lagging behind despite the boom that we have recently enjoyed. With all the money we have now because of oil price hikes, we could do much, much more than we have, but we have not, and it will cost us in the long run. We have third-class education in terms of quality. We have lots of quantity, but not enough quality. And so the question becomes, where will our leaders come from? How will we compete globally if we cannot produce more students who might someday be effective as global leaders?" Institutions versus individuals. The rise of global institutions, dominated by transnational corporations, but including global non-governmental organizations, churches, media networks, and shadow alliances among terrorists or criminals, is a driving factor in the emergence of the global superclass. When the chief executives of big companies became responsible for global rather than national operations, when their growth started coming from abroad rather than from home, those CEOs became global citizens and global power brokers. Indeed, it is the rise of powerful, high-functioning, rich global organizations that is at the heart of many of the challenges that international systems face today. National governments are increasingly like the Lilliputians trying to bind the giant Gulliver to the ground. Acting alone, they can't achieve their goal of influencing the behavior of entities that now can choose between domiciles and foreign direct investments based on the active competition of governments for their favor. Acting together, they may, for a time. But their own orientation, where power is derived from reflecting the will of a local population, often in the context of local issues, is not suited to such collaboration. The result is a world of loping Gullivers, among whom only a few very big governments have anything like the stature or resources to measure up to them in terms of global influence. One senior government official from the Middle East with whom I spoke argued that the members of the superclass were not truly elites because they did not derive their influence from something intrinsic to them or their families, but from the organizations for which they work. It was a complaint I heard several times in preparing the book, but my response remains the same. The superclass is a power elite. Just as C. Wright Mills observed that the U.S. power elite in the 1950s was no longer the inherited old money of early America, but that they had been supplanted by corporate elites tied to big companies, warlords, and other power clusters linked to big institutions. So it is with this group. They are elites because they are powerful, not powerful because they are elites. And in almost every case, large organizations have, for obvious reasons, vastly more power and resources than do individuals. Thus, virtually all of the members of the superclass are atop the global power pyramid because they also occupy a top position within an institutional power pyramid, or because they can influence them by directing their capital, their views, or their networks of supporters in one way or another. The emerging superclass, a coming culture shock? Although there are almost no circumstances in which anyone would call Steve Schwarzman average, he is in many ways an average member of the superclass. He is white, American, male, at the time of this recording 60 years old, and the chief executive of a global firm that he and partner Pete Peterson built from nothing. He is active in the arts, serving as chairman of the Kennedy Center, influential in politics, and attended Yale and Harvard Business School. He has an exceptional network of influential colleagues and friends and access to leaders worldwide. His firm also owns 47 companies with more than $85 billion in revenues. He made almost $2 billion when the company went public in 2007. When he celebrated his 60th birthday, the entertainment was provided by Rod Stewart and Patti LaBelle. Okay, so in some ways he is perhaps somewhat above average, even for the superclass. The question is, will Steve Schwarzman be a typical member of the superclass if he is still active in, say, 20 years? This is hard to predict, but given the fact that China is the world's most rapidly growing major economy, that it is fueling growth throughout Asia, and that India, soon to surpass China in population, is not far behind, it seems more likely that as Schwarzman celebrates his 80th birthday, the average member of the superclass will be the son of Li Ka-shing, the chairman of both Hutchison Whampoa Limited and Chung Kong Holdings, Asia's richest investor and, as of 2007, the ninth richest man in the world, with more than $23 billion. The younger Li was born in 1966 and today is chairman of Hong Kong's leading telecom company, PCCW, and Pacific Century Group. In 2007, Richard Li ranked 754th on the Forbes billionaire list and was worth $1.3 billion. American-educated, although he did not finish his degree at Stanford, he earned initial fame starting Star TV for $250 million and later selling it to Rupert Murdoch for $950 million. He has since invested heavily in technology and real estate. PCCW is the world's largest provider of television via the Internet, one of the trends that NBC's Bob Wright felt would ultimately transform the global media business. While Li's career path has not been without its challenges, he remains not only an heir to the region's richest man and a powerful figure in his own right, but he has carefully networked into the global elite. He holds positions such as a governor of the World Economic Forum's Information Technologies and Telecommunications Group, a counselor to Washington think tank the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and an advisor to Harvard's Center for International Development. He is also a dual citizen of Hong Kong and of Canada, making him even more literally a model for the trans-Pacific superclass of tomorrow. By 2028, Li will undoubtedly be joined in these ranks by many from the rising class of Chinese business superstars. In considerable contrast to the United States and Europe, as of this recording, almost half of the 25 richest people in China are under 45. Only 4 are over 60. The richest, as of 2007, Yang Huian, is 26. Many of these rising stars are also active globalists in the vein of Richard Li. Xi Zhengrong is an Australian whose solar energy company, SunTech, is listed on the Nasdaq stock market. William Ding Lei runs NetEase.com, also Nasdaq listed, which offers many Chinese an internet portal to the world. Zhang Changfei of Nine Dragons defers to his older sister and one of China's richest women, Zhang Yin, in the management of a company that is one of the world's leaders in the manufacture and sale of paperboard. While China's economy may falter during the coming two decades, it is difficult to foresee any credible scenario in which the number of Asian companies among the world's most important does not rise. As the region's economies grow, so too will the number of its elites, who already are included among the world's richest. According to Merrill Lynch and Capgemini, dollar millionaires in China increased by 6.8% to 320,000 in 2005, and their average net worth was $5 million. Between 2006 and 2007, the number of billionaires vaulted up from 15 to 106. Chinese were among the largest sources of newcomers to Forbes' rich list in 2007, lagging just behind India and Russia. In short, the region's elites are likely to make up an ever-growing share of the global superclass. What might this mean? On the one hand, it could mean that the superclass will be less cohesive than it has been in eras in which it was dominated by representatives of Western countries with common cultural and historical backgrounds, as it is today. On the other, it could mean that, in order to compete, to take advantage of the opportunities of the global economy, to assume more prominent roles in the global community, more and more Asian business leaders will work to remove obstacles to communication with established leaders. This can already be seen in the growing number who speak English or who have been educated in Western schools. But it would be naive and more than a little condescending to think that the rise of Asia among the world's power elite will result in the westernization of Asian leaders. Quite the contrary, it is more likely that the lure of Asia's rapidly growing markets will result in more and more Westerners adapting to growing Asian influence. China is already exhibiting that influence in its global quest for resources, building ties with countries in Africa, Latin America, and elsewhere. It is doing so, moreover, through a different approach to investment and government-to-government relations than found in competitors like the United States, one that is more values-free and is all about the deal. As former National Security Advisor Sandy Berger observed, there has been a tremendous shift of power and influence from West to East, and the real American dominance, which existed for the last 50 years, is certainly not sustainable. We are throwing our weight around, but the weight is comparatively lighter, and the Chinese and others are getting savvier and savvier about how they cultivate international relationships, which they do in a way that is quite different from ours. If the superclass exerts influence by agenda setting and shaping conventional wisdom, not through a set process of control, but simply through the alignment of interests around a given issue, what will happen when the culture of those with the influence changes? Won't the conventional wisdom change too? It is likely that it will. Many may embrace the idea of a world in which the Asian approach of trying to stay non-judgmental about internal issues offsets the Western proselytizing tradition. China and India have not in modern history been global imperial powers seeking to impose their will far beyond their borders, though they certainly have had border issues. To the contrary, India was a colony of such a power, and parts of China found themselves under the heel of imperial powers. They seek influence, of course, but their approach and priorities are different. While the United States and the Europeans have surely gone too far in attempting to influence other nations' internal affairs, often in a strikingly hypocritical and inconsistent way, that does not necessarily mean it would be a good thing for the world's community of leaders to become less value-oriented. There is right and wrong in the world, and it is the responsibility of members of the global community to seek to identify and eliminate the wrong when it poses a threat to peace and stability. Sometimes it is appropriate to judge and to use influence to try and change abhorrent or dangerous behavior. But the world's power elite may be shifting in a somewhat different direction. Will other values change? Regarding best practices? Regarding how we weigh stability versus democracy, or the role of the individual versus that of the state? It is quite possible that if the fastest growing groups within the superclass hail from the cowboy economies of the emerging world, this may produce more tolerance for corruption, for example. Or it may be that a more go-slow approach to global warming will be adopted, given the resistance of emerging economies to pay for environmental technologies and higher environmental standards, especially as the West was never constrained by these concerns during its period of rapid growth. My sense is that what will happen will be like much else that takes place within the world of the superclass. There will be thousands of individual and small group dynamics, negotiations, tugs of war, that will gradually have the cumulative effect of pulling groups together. As the center of gravity shifts, some of the core values will shift as well to be more acceptable to the growing number of influential figures with Asian views. But it also seems that the concentration of capital resources in the developed world, the leverage of having that capital, and the nature of markets will likely combine to act as a check against behaviors investors find worrisome, such as corruption or reckless policymaking, for example. These factors will shape the second major chain in the superclass during the next 20 years, as those from regions that were less dependent on global markets and international standards become more exposed to and dependent on those forces. The future is not just more Asian, therefore. It is full of emerging elites that will act according to the same standards all players in global markets must adhere to. China's struggles to enforce safety regulations on the products it exports are a perfect illustration of how this happens. Its failure to effectively enforce intellectual property protections suggests another area in which the teeth of the marketplace have yet to sink in and change behaviors. Global governance versus global government. In a number of areas, members of the superclass have stepped in to help fill the void in global governance. Business leaders engage in what is essentially self-regulation. Unelected clusters of the most powerful in national governments effectively drive governments' decision-making on global issues, and empowered individuals direct private resources that have become the sine qua non of development capital flows. These are all important strands of the connective tissue binding the global community. The superclass confronts issues that many national governments and multilateral organizations cannot or will not address. Throughout history, many have reflexively reacted against the idea of global government as a betrayal of local or national identity, a shifting of decision-making farther away from home and therefore away from local interests. Such distrust has been strengthened due to the fact that the only effective mechanisms for imposing such governance have been empires, which asserted the will of the few over the many, and the generally feeble or defective 20th century international institutions that have had few effective enforcement mechanisms associated with them and that have often lacked either initiative or coherence. There have, however, been champions of the idea of more effective mechanisms of global citizenship, from ancient times through Dante, Hobbes, Kant, and in the last century through Bertrand Russell, Einstein, and Gandhi, suggesting that the idea is sustained by an appeal greater than the abuses and missteps of several thousand years could subdue. The selective enforcement of the law and the selective protection of the basic rights of individuals are among the most dangerous recurring impulses of unprincipled leaders throughout history. This concept has been used to justify holding certain people or certain institutions above the law and others beneath and unprotected by it, or to claim that national laws and values no longer need to be adhered to beyond national borders or along the divides that separate civilizations. The result is the collapse of moral order and the potential for great horror. Ultimately, as the generation that emerged from World War II seeking to establish a global system governed by law and common principles saw, the global community must redress and undo these imbalances for the sake of its own preservation. Injustice threatens social stability, and injustice is amplified by the fact that today's mechanisms of government are effectively obsolete. In a world of global movements and threats that don't present their passports at national borders, it is no longer possible for a nation-state acting alone to fulfill its portion of the social contract. Of course, even the international organizations and alliances we have today, flawed as they are, would have seemed impossible until recently. Notably, the success of the European Union, a unitary democratic state the size of India. The evolution and achievements of such entities against all odds suggest not isolated instances, but an overall trend in the direction of what Tennyson called the Parliament of Man, or universal law. For these reasons, I am optimistic that progress will continue to be made. But it will be progress into a strong headwind, as it undercuts many national and local power structures and cultural concepts that have foundations deep in the bedrock of human civilization, namely the notion of sovereignty. Long accustomed to dismissing as an impossible and perhaps even dangerous fantasy the idea of global government, but recognizing the need to better manage global issues, many have focused on the idea of global governance as an alternative. Typically, this substitution of a few letters is a kind of code that means fulfilling government roles with mechanisms that either lack the full traditional power, authority, or mandates of governments, or with hybrids that involve both governments and other actors, such as the private sector or NGOs, or some combination of all these. The arguments in favor of such approaches have many important merits. Mechanisms of global governance are more achievable in today's environment. As conceived of or in practice, they draw on the legitimacy of participant entities such as states, plus the capability and diversity of non-governmental participants to achieve a quasi-governmental feel and to fulfill their goals. They are also generally less hierarchic and more network-driven, a sign for many that they are better suited to our globalized times. Certainly, they are often creative with temporary solutions to urgent problems that cannot wait for the world to embrace a bigger and more controversial idea like real global government. These examples exist on many levels. One is the welter of multilateral, national, and private authorities that collaborate through the connections between organizations. For instance, internet domain names are managed through an association of ICANN, I-C-A-N-N, Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, CENTER, C-E-N-T-R, Council of European National Top-Level Domain Registries, the World Intellectual Property Organization, the United Nations, and the private sector. The process has been complex and sometimes tense, but it has produced a number of global agreements on the management of key elements of the global electronic commons that is the Internet. In ICANN, the Internet pioneer Vint Cerf sees an emerging model for what global governance institutions might look like. We have something of an interesting experiment because it is a multi-stakeholder organization. It includes governments, private sector, civil society, and the academic world. The attempt to draw those different sectors together in order to do policy development has certainly been a lesson, if nothing else. There has been an enormous amount of tension among those various interested parties. We have competitors who are trying to cooperate to make policy. Of course, they are very hesitant to do anything that would damage their business interests. As we continue to see this erosion of national boundaries, I wonder whether we will see multi-stakeholder structures showing up that are not solely of governments. The notion of such hybrid networks of institutions and actors is a promising one, and it is a central concept in the evolving public debate on these issues. It is linked to views such as those in the Dean of Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School, Anne Marie Slaughter's A New World Order, which explores how we can make more effective use of international networks of government agencies and officials. It also echoes views that are increasingly acceptable to the international community of business as well, because the investment in hybrid networks emulates the way international business strategic alliances regularly work today. Some speculate that this approach will win support from the private sector, as we have seen the ascendant force in the global superclass, to help bring order to the potential chaos of the unregulated global marketplace. Richard Darman speculates that we will reach a stage where companies facing a choice between multiple regulating authorities worldwide that are not in coordination and a more coordinated regulatory arrangement will themselves become a force for the very institutional developments they say they currently oppose. Is it going to be a series of ad hoc connections, topic area by topic area, that will develop that way first exactly because nation states do not want to see sovereignty threatened? Probably yes. Is there a stage at which some global authority starts to have serious taxing power, which will be, in fact, a precondition to having some fundamental change in political and governing power worldwide? I do not expect that in my lifetime. Darman is not alone in this view. Virtually everyone whom I interviewed about the superclass fell in the range of not in my lifetime and never on the question of progress toward real and effective institutions of international government. This was true from Asia to Latin America, Europe to the Middle East and the United States. At the same time, all had come to accept the idea that new mechanisms of global governance were needed. Members of the global superclass may see this trend as a challenge, given their current dominant role in shaping the informal mechanisms of global governance to their advantage. They may well feel threatened by efforts to create other mechanisms in which their power is compromised or challenged by interest groups that do not share their goals. On the other hand, some among them will see the world as Darman does, gradually recognizing that order and legitimacy are the allies of both business and of those who seek social stability. This tension will be as important to the future of the superclass as it is to the world. Is a crisis inevitable? Beyond that tension, however, is the threat of even greater instability. As one European business leader observed to me, if the elites make these decisions, if these elites are as influential as they seem to be, countries may be protecting sovereignty, but people are going to end up divided worldwide. If the global decisions that take place out there serve only the powerful, and many of the people making the decisions are not elected or chosen by the people, the average person is going to recognize they have less influence. So it won't just be unfair, it will produce a backlash. People will say, I don't want to be part of the world because I can't control it. Such views will continue to be exploited by populists like Venezuela's Chavez, and such accusations will continue to make the fault line between internationalists and nationalists, populists, among the most volatile on the planet. The current global system seems to many people to be fundamentally unjust. The richest get much richer, and the great majority of others struggle to remain in place. For much of the period of the greatest wealth creation known, the 1980s and 90s, the message to the poorest nations from leading countries and their friends in the financial community was that austerity today produces benefits tomorrow. But for all the merits of such an approach on an economic level, it was politically unsustainable. It was also in some very real ways immoral, suggesting that paying back major financial institutions automatically ought to take priority over meeting the most urgent human needs. It was a question of balance, of how much austerity, how fast, of how much for the people and how much for the banks. And in many, many places from Argentina to Southeast Asia, the balance was wrong, and it produced political instability and ultimately the discrediting of the IMF and the leading moneylenders in the eyes of many. The balance has also been off in the progress of global trade liberalization. Freer trade, which benefits everyone, has been threatened by the fact that those who advocated it were not sensitive enough to the dislocations it causes. The view, effectively, was, let's focus today on what helps the big guys, and the little guys will be helped over time. Or, let's focus on the deals today, we can get to the environment later. I have been a part of those discussions while in the government and since, and have said such things. And I have been, as were my colleagues and counterparts elsewhere in the world, wrong. Not in the thrust or ultimate goal, but in emphasis. Similarly, critics see the incredible imbalances that exist on the security side as the overreaching or the self-dealing of the powerful. Why should just a few nations have nuclear weapons? I know why I don't like the idea of a state sponsor of terrorism run by a dangerous guy like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad acquiring nuclear weapons. I even know why I would support strong multilateral measures to keep him from getting them. But I can't for the life of me figure out a logically or ethically sound rationale for why the United States should be allowed to have such weapons and small countries should not, especially given that the United States is the only country to have actually used nuclear weapons, twice, on civilian populations. I suppose it makes sense from the perspective that they are an acknowledged evil, and job one is to contain their spread, after which we will eliminate them where they are. But the efforts to eliminate them where they are have been too slow and not very serious. Indeed, the problem is being exacerbated by the fact that the United States is developing a new generation of nukes. Only by showing that they are committed to an equitable outcome will the powerful nations tamp down opposition and accusations of hypocrisy. This hostility is reinforced over and over as the most powerful violate international laws with impunity and consolidate influence and advantage in what are supposed to be representative institutions of global governance. We are risking backlash. It has happened throughout history. While it seems impossible now to imagine a real divergence from the popularly perceived course of progress over the past 50 years, we should remember that it was also impossible to foresee the fall of the Soviet Union or the reversals that have threatened democracy in America in the first year of this century. It was likewise difficult to imagine how America's reaction to 9/11 could produce a global backlash against America. The internationalist-nationalist tensions have already produced reactionary efforts among the new non-aligned, but they are also informing more mainstream efforts, such as the efforts of Nicolas Sarkozy to present himself as the internationalist-nationalist, pro-EU but anti-immigration and anti-Turkish EU accession. The emergence of such hybrid positions is likely to change the agenda for the agenda setters. How the balance of their power tips the scales is the key to whether they will be able to forestall cascading public reaction against real and perceived global imbalances, or whether they will be able to respond to the threat in advance and constructively rein in the impulse to overreach, the irresistible impulse that has been the downfall of elites throughout history. On balance. The real story, therefore, is not about the likes of Teodoro Obiang, accidental member of the superclass. It is about the elites who embrace him or enable him. In past eras, most elites were national, and their support could dictate the future of princes and prime ministers, the fate of coalitions within their borders, the rise and fall of individuals and initiatives that had a domestic power base. But the center of gravity of elites has shifted. Today, the most powerful elites are global citizens tied more to international finance than national politics. Obiang, without the international oil companies, is nothing but a dime store dictator. Without a sponsor like the United States or China, nation states that are so dependent on global resources to fund their economies and militaries that old distinctions between domestic and international interests have no meaning for them, Obiang and his ilk are no different from 1,000 warlords, gangsters, or ward politicians who claim a small piece of turf until someone more ruthless comes along. If the richest and most powerful individuals in the world are now predominantly globally oriented, globally dependent, globally active, then an important shift has taken place in the world's balance of power, away from national governments and away from national interests narrowly defined. And we have seen that this transformation is more than hype. Globalization is not just some kind of fad or geopolitical flavor of the month. In every one of the clusters we have examined, it becomes clear that the most powerful are the most global. As I have noted, today, for the first time, more than half the revenues of the largest companies, like the ones that make up the S&P 500, are international. For the few major defense contractors that remain after years of consolidation, global markets are key to growth and, of course, global tensions the engine of demand for their products. All of the biggest media companies are seeking global reach, and in doing so, seeking to influence global cultural norms to suit their commercial interests. The great religions are transnational, and those religions that remain trapped within national borders wither and lose influence. Even the most powerful nations, like the United States, China, and the other countries of the G8, are heavily dependent on international investment flows, international borrowing, and international trade for their growth. Most developed nations are aging and face demographic crises that only immigration can solve. Elections may be local, but national political leaders must think internationally very quickly. Even the leaders of small countries are so dependent on foreign investment flows that to some degree they report simultaneously to their people and to Wall Street traders. Indeed, this is also true for leaders of powerful countries. The power elites of C. Wright Mills's era were primarily Americans with American interests. Their country had become a global power, but international issues were still literally foreign. Permanent overseas engagement was something new that these elites were just learning to understand, both militarily and commercially. Transnational corporations came to dominate, the result of progress in technology and Cold War alliances that established the infrastructure and the economic momentum toward what we now call the global era. And as these national elites succeeded in this enterprise, their interests shifted. National elites remain, but for the most part, on most issues, they are trumped by the scale, resources, networks, and power of their more globally oriented rivals. Tensions remain between the two, and the national elites have tradition and cultural ballast to help them hold their ground, but the handwriting is on the wall. Protectionism or reactionary nationalism may reassert itself, perhaps with devastating consequences, perhaps for decades to come. But it is likely that these reactions will be seen as transitional spasms, growing pains, as people struggle to come to grips with the redefinition of core ideas like sovereignty, community, identity, local, and foreign. To a large extent, it is up to the global power elites themselves to determine how long and how destructive those spasms will be. If they use their influence to create a global system of rules that exacerbates inequalities and is as patently unjust as is the current system, crisis is virtually inevitable. However, if they recognize that it is in their central interest to move away from approaches that offer today to the rich and powerful, while offering the promise of a distant tomorrow to the poor and the disenfranchised, then they may avoid the fate of past elites that were brought down due to their overreaching, greed, insensitivity, and short-sightedness. The critical issue is balance. Where democracy may have been wanting, we have felt that freer markets might somehow make up the difference. But time and time again we have seen that market mechanisms and dictatorship, or oligarchy or illiberal democracy, go hand in hand. We have learned the hard way that the institutions or accoutrements of democracy are not enough if they are not accompanied by the culture of democracy. So do markets become illiberal if they offer the appearance of free competition without a level playing field, without truly equal opportunity for all. The answer does not lie in the reflexive protection of national sovereignty. This impedes the creation and empowerment of those mechanisms of international governance, some perhaps new and very different from what past generations have come to expect, that are essential to rebalancing freedom and justice, to rebalancing the power of the superclass and the power of the masses worldwide. Nor does the answer lie in a world without global elites. For all their deficiencies, or for all the deficiencies of the system they have helped create, many in this group have made enormous contributions to the well-being of the planet. We will always want and need leaders. The measure of our success in redistributing resources within our global system will be the degree to which we can balance our need for such leadership and for the incentives that help the best among us rise to greatness. We must recognize that society, including those elites, has to make the needs of those least able to help themselves its number one priority. Further, we must recognize that this is not purely an economic issue. Justice depends on those poor having not just a political voice, but also a fair share of political power, power in which the measure of one's influence is not altered by economic factors, in which that power is a birthright of every individual. The great challenge of this century, and perhaps the centuries ahead, will be to accept that the era of the nation-state as we have known it, born in the 17th century and brought to fruition over the following 400 years, has ended. While national governments will and certainly should remain a vital part of the global system, they are no longer enough, no longer adequate to fulfill their basic promises to their people. In a global world, we cannot protect people's rights only through actions within national borders. Build that fence along the border. It will prove to be the Maginot Line of globalization, a pathetic reminder of the folly of past wars and the failure to rise to new challenges. In the same way, reducing the importance of national borders, while not recognizing the impenetrability of economic and social boundaries that separate the majority of the world's people from control of their destiny, is a formula not for the first years of globalization, but for the last. If the people at large do not become stakeholders in globalization, then they will become its enemies and its undoing. Sitting far away from those disenfranchised, whether during a fondue lunch in a small restaurant in Davos or atop an office tower in Santiago, perhaps flying far overhead in a custom-fitted Gulfstream jet, the members of the superclass are, in the end, the people who can do the most to eliminate those threatening divides. Until they do, using their financial or institutional levers as business people, or the power of the government, military, media, or cultural institutions they lead, the process and the promise of globalization as an opening and leveling force will remain incomplete, and the good it can bring will remain at risk. But the superclass cannot do it alone, nor will they. History has shown that. Without the emergence of countervailing power centers to represent and ultimately institutionalize the will of the people at large, we will continue to get only partial solutions. History is the story of a negotiation between the rich and powerful and the less fortunate but still dangerous, a bargaining over the price that must be paid for stability. The poor and weak are never at the table. In era after era, the deals brokered have been inadequate, with the rich winning today and gaining an advantage in the future, while the poor get crumbs today and only the promise of a better life generations hence. It is a lousy deal, and it has never held for long. The questions, then, that we and the superclass must ask are, who will make the first moves for change this time? What form will they take? Will elites once again be deposed by other elites acting in the name of the people but actually representing their own narrow interests? Or will progress finally offer lasting proof that true stability lies in balance between freedom and justice, between growth and equity, between market and state, and between the few who would lead and the rest of us, from whom the legitimacy of leaders must flow? This concludes Superclass. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.